know who you are.
So
Okay, everybody, I think we'll just get the evening started. My name is Morag Park. I'm the director of the Goodman Cancer Research Center, and I want to welcome all of you for coming here this evening. This is a slightly different direction for us at the center. We're listening to you. We've asked you in the coming who have come to the past forums, what did you want to hear? And one of the areas that you told us was prevention. What should we know about prevention, and why is that important to us nowadays? And I think, you know, we have to look at sobering facts. If we look at the statistics for 2013, there were 96,000 men and 91,000 women diagnosed with cancer in Canada. This boiled down to 500 people a day diagnosed with cancer, and 200 people a day dying from cancer in this country alone. But what's quite worrying is that about 25 to 30% of cancers could be avoided. They're considered to be avoidable by changes in lifestyle and other types of activities. So I think it is important that we begin to address what is prevention. How should we think about it, and how should we be aware of it? And obviously, an evening like this, we've drawn from researchers across the whole of Montreal, and we'll have discussions that will really introduce us to how to think about this. And obviously, one goal would be how do we build innovative research and truly understanding in a quantitative manner what prevention means for cancer. And I would like to turn the chair over now to Nicole Beauchemin, who many of you know, who hosts many of our forums. And I think what we have to acknowledge, Nicole has been spearheading the forums for us at the Goodman Cancer Research Center. And without us, I don't think we'd have this turnout. This has really been built by Nicole and championed by Nicole. And I'd like you then just to be thanked and say thank you.
Thank you very much for being here tonight. As you see, we're in the other auditorium, and we had to move because the other one was too full. So I think you should applaud everyone for being here. Je vais répéter en français pour quelques minutes ce que Morague a dit en anglais. Elle aurait pu le faire en français, mais elle se sentait un peu intimidée. On a décidé ce soir de faire une session sur la prévention. En réponse à vos demandes, dans vos paquets, vous avez essentiellement un formulaire où on vous demande ce que vous aimeriez entendre l'année prochaine. Et je vous engage à répondre. I urge you to respond to this survey that you have in your packages because we will be starting to prepare next year. And we want to know what you want us to prepare for you. La prévention, ça devrait être au cœur de notre action. 96 000 hommes et 91 000 femmes ont été diagnostiqués en 2013 avec un cancer. Ça veut dire 500 personnes par jour ont reçu ce mauvais diagnostic. 200 personnes par jour meurent de cancer. Ça représente le cancer 30 % de toutes les maladies dont les Canadiens décèdent chaque année. Et pourtant, si on en était plus conscient et si on savait comment mieux écouter notre corps et changer nos habitudes de vie, on pourrait probablement prévenir au moins 25 % sinon plus de ces cancers. The people we have gathered tonight are experts in a wide variety of fields. They will answer questions at the end, as we normally do. You have in your packages some cue cards. Please write the questions that you would like us to ask them at the end. We'll have volunteers collecting these cue cards near the end, so we can ask the questions. Vous avez dans les feuilles qu'on vous a remis des petites cartes pour écrire les questions que vous aimeriez qu'on pose à nos conférenciers à la fin de la soirée. Il y aura des bénévoles qui vont circuler plus tard dans la soirée pour ramasser ces cartes et nous répondrons aux questions. As you see, we are trying to cater to all communities in English et en français. I can't promise that I'll go any further than that tonight, but maybe next year. So our first speaker tonight, we juggled around because we had one speaker who was was first in all of your announcements. He's going back to first. You've graduated, Michael. Michael Pollack is going to talk to us tonight on new ideas in cancer prevention. Michael is well known in the Montreal community. He is the director of the Cancer Prevention Center at the Siegel Cancer Center, the Jewish General Hospital. He's the director of the Division of Cancer Prevention in the Department of Oncology. He's the Alexander Goldfarb Research Chair in Medical Oncology. He's a professor in the Departments of Medicine and Oncology. And, of course, he's from McGill University. We turn the floor over to you. We have automatic.
Okay. So, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to be able to tell you a little bit about the field of cancer prevention and what we can do and what we cannot do. There's a few points to begin with, just to give you a perspective of how hard it is to prevent cancer and what we're up against. You know, every cell in your body could become cancerous. There's no cell that's really completely unable to become cancer. And there's many, many cells. Each of you have more cells in your body than there are people on Earth. So that therefore, even if one of these goes wrong, you would get potentially a cancer. So as you're working in the field of cancer prevention, often you're thinking in very different perspectives. One is the troubling statistics that you've just heard in the introduction, that cancer is so frequent. But biologically, sometimes we wonder, you know, the opposite perspective. Why isn't that we all don't have much more cancer? I mean, because the risks in a certain sense are so high. Because, you know, each person considers themselves one person at risk. But one person at risk is really billions of cells at risk. So a person who's cancer-free actually has billions of cells that each one of them behaved. So it's a very interesting field, and I'll give you some specific examples. So cancer control is a term that we use to deal with the whole problem of cancer. And by cancer control, we include cancer prevention efforts, cancer screening efforts, and cancer treatment efforts. And all of these are very important. And on a global basis, you know, there's key elements that bear repeating that are listed here: tobacco control, avoidance of obesity, avoidance of carcinogenic industrial exposures, and screening where feasible. Now, just a word about screening. Some people are understandably confused. They think that screening is prevention, but there is a distinction. Screening doesn't really prevent cancer. Screening saves lives in some cases by finding cancers early. It doesn't really prevent them from happening, but it allows early detection, which may allow for cure. So screening is very important. It's a component of the overall cancer control efforts. But screening finds cancer early, which is different from really preventing it. So if a smoker stops smoking, there's a chance that he's really or she is really going to prevent cancer. If you have a colonoscopy and find an early polyp, well, you may have saved a life. In a sense, you've prevented trouble. But you actually just found a tumor early. Okay. So we don't have a complete understanding of the causes of all cancers. We're in early days of development of prevention. And we don't have an effective universal strategy. And we have a lot to learn. We can learn from our colleagues in cardiology. Because when you want to prevent a heart attack, you know that you have to lower your blood pressure. You know that you have to lower your cholesterol. We do this all the time. But if you stop and think about it, we only define high cholesterol as a disease because it's a risk factor for what we really want to prevent. So what's the analogy for cancer? I mean, what's the high cholesterol of cancer? That's kind of one of our big research topics. What can you go to at a doctor's office, which would be analogous to gauge your cancer risk? Well, we don't really have many such things. I mean, in some cases, there's genetic problems that explain and underlie cancer in families, and we can make use of that. But that's not really something that's applicable for the vast majority of cancers. So, as I said, we lack this analogy of a simple test that would gauge risk. And cholesterol is great because not only does it enable our cardiology colleagues to tell what the risk is, this person high risk, this person low risk, but it has implications of what to do about it. If your cholesterol is high, you lower it. So, as I said, you understand now that screening is one thing and that it's an important activity, but it's not actually prevention. And when we talk about prevention at the Cancer Center, we try to be more specific because some people think that all cancer therapy and everything should be called cancer prevention. You know, they would, and this is just wording, they would say, well, you want to prevent the disease from spreading. You want to prevent pain. You want to prevent suffering. So if you use the word prevention very loosely, it comprises everything. It even includes palliative care. It includes treatment. And includes what I would call real prevention. So when I talk about prevention, I mean taking a person who is perhaps destined to get cancer if they don't change their ways and prevent it in the first place. I do not call palliative care is very important, and we'd like to prevent pain, but that's really it's confusing to call that cancer prevention. So we have here a list of some of the prevention strategies: reduction in carcinogen exposure. That means, for example, in industrial contexts, not working in an asbestos mine. Some other contexts that we use, sometimes we have to remove organs at risk. You know, if you have a lifetime genetic risk of breast cancer of 80%, you might want to remove your breasts. An important area is to reduce predisposing infections. Viruses can cause cancer. So papillomavirus is cancer of the cervix. Very important, you can control that kind of cancer by reducing the number of infections. And then there's this thing here, modification of renewal kinetics of epithelial cells at risk. What does that mean? Well, if you have, let's say, an organ that's predisposed to at risk for cancer, let's say a colon. Well, the colon, you know, every week, or even more quickly than that, all the cells of your colon are replaced. You may be 50 years old, but the lining of your colon is only a week old because all through your life, these cells are being born and dying very quickly. So there's a huge amount of normal cell birth and normal cell death. And if that process is happening very fast, there's more chance for an accident to occur. So these are other areas that we can work in to slow down cells that are dividing too quickly. So reduction in carcinogen exposure, a little bit more about that in detail here. We have to be careful here not to be overly simplifying. We have to be realistic. Oh, sorry. I don't know if I can back up here. Yes. Natural carcinogens are very real. It is a fallacy to think that everything that's man-made causes cancer and everything that's natural is safe. There are some very potent natural carcinogens. There's a kind of mold that can grow on peanuts that is a very carcinogenic and perfectly natural substance. So we must not say that that everything that's natural is safe. And we have real big difficulties in studying some of the exposures to risk in relationship to cancers because of the long latency period. What does that mean? Well, if you're exposed to a carcinogen, you won't get cancer the next day. You may get cancer 5, 10, even 15 years later. It takes a long time in some cases, for the carcinogen to act. So a lot of the research in this area is actually rather difficult. You can't survey people in terms of what their exposures are this week and then say, well, these exposures were dangerous, people got cancer the next month. You have to observe populations for years to understand this process. It's one of the challenges in the field. I'm just going to illustrate here one example of a controversy that I think is instructive. PCBs are famous chemicals that, you know, are health hazards. This, I won't take you through this in detail, but there was a very large study reported in a very good journal that said that PCBs, which were putative carcinogens for the breast, they actually studied the blood levels of PCB and followed the women for many, many years, and they found out that there was no relationship between the amount of carcinogens in the blood and the risk of breast cancer. That was a big surprise. And we think now we have some insight into why that result was what it was. And I'm going to explain it to you, and I'm going to hope you understand how hard it is to study some of these issues. You see, PCBs are what we call lipophilic. They're attracted to fat. Actually, there's a lot of fat in the breast. There's not very much fat, in that sense, in the circulation. So this study was actually true in as far as it went, but they were looking in the wrong place, because the fact that there's no relationship between PCBs in your blood and breast cancer risk does not really address the real question, which is the relationship between PCB concentrations in the at-risk breast tissue and risk. But how are researchers supposed to deal with that? Because it's easy to ask women to give a blood sample, but you can't very well ask women to give a breast sample. So this question remains largely unanswered, and it's an example of how you can easily get what some people would consider to be false negative results. This doesn't mean that PCBs are safe. It means that it's a harder question than it first appears to answer. Okay, so I just said all that. Here's another example which I think is instructive and topical. Breast cancer and smoking. So there was lots written about breast cancer and smoking. Smoking causes many cancers. You all know about lung, but bladder cancer is strongly related to smoking as well. Head and neck cancers, many cancers. But breast cancer was always regarded as kind of exceptional because really, in the initial surveys, there was no relationship between smoking and breast cancer. Some women with breast cancer smoked a lot, some didn't. There seemed to be no effect. Until it was realized that there's an actual kind of critical period. You see, if girls are smoking around the time of their... Oh, sorry. If girls are smoking around the time of menarche, early teenagers or even younger ages, if girls smoke early, they do increase their risk of breast cancer, not quite doubling it. If you smoke as an adult woman, it's very bad for other cancers, but it's not really a risk factor for breast cancer. So you see, around the time when the breasts are developing, they are susceptible to breast carcinogens, and they do increase breast cancer risk. So this is an important message for young girls. And there's another issue, which is alcohol. I'm diverting a little bit from my slides here, but alcohol is a similar situation. The breast is specifically vulnerable around the time when the breast is actually developing as an organ. And so if you are an adult woman, there are recommendations, and we know that alcohol excess is a risk factor for breast cancer. But it's more of a risk factor if you're drinking too much as a 13-year-old girl than if you're drinking too much as a 60-year-old woman. So another issue there is just to review, where is the carcinogen? You might not find it in the blood. You might have to look in the tissue. And then the exposure times, it's more complicated than it would appear at first. Okay, now, tobacco control. Well, this is a huge issue, and the basic research is finished. We know. But we still have a huge avoidable burden of cancers related to tobacco, and obviously the application of our knowledge is completely inadequate. So this is an area of activity, you know, for behavioral scientists, for addiction researchers. In a sense, they're part of the army of people waging the war on cancer. Smokers who don't quit are not necessarily stupid or evil. They just can't quit. They're addicted. And so, you know, addiction research becomes part of cancer prevention research. How am I for time? 3 minutes. I'll give you one other example of a research topic that's related to the cancer prevention, and that's hormonal factors. Hormones are related to many cancers. Some are obvious, like estrogens in breast cancer, or androgens like testosterone in prostate cancer. But there's other hormones, like this one, insulin-like growth factor, which are also related to cancers in a more general sense. And this goes back to the idea that our tissues are always renewing themselves, that your colon may only be a week old even if you are 60 years old. And the hormone levels of this particular hormone and other growth factors vary a great deal between people. So some people have high levels of this, and some people have lower levels of this. And those who have higher levels actually have higher levels of cell renewal. And we know that this is partly determined by genetic factors and partly related to lifestyle factors, particularly diet. So if you eat too much, you have higher levels of this and other hormones. And that causes the rate of cell proliferation to increase. And that gives more opportunity for accidents of a carcinogenic nature to occur. So we have an example of a person who might have a lower level of this hormone, another person who might have a higher level of the hormone. Part of the variation can be altered by lifestyle changes. In particular, by attention to not overeating. If you eat too much, the hormone level goes up, the proliferation rate goes up, and the risk of cancer also goes up. Nowhere near as important as smoking. But if you look at the population as a whole and the rates of overeating in our society, it still accounts for a lot surplus and preventable cancers. I have more slides, but I also have colleagues who have important messages. So there could be some other topics that I can go into in more detail in the question period. But I hope now I've given you some examples of some of the issues in cancer prevention research that workers in that field deal with every day. Thank you. Do we take questions now?
No, not yet.
I think we're having questions at the end, I'm told.
So our second, thank you, Michael. So our second speaker for tonight is Dr. Corin Mann. Dr. Mann is a basic researcher. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Oncology. She's an associate member of the Goodman Cancer Research Center. She works at McGill University, but she's sort of across the hill over at the Lady Davis Institute for Medical Research. Welcome, Corinne.
Got it. Thanks, Nicole, Marijke. It's very nice to be invited to give this talk, and Michael's done a great job introducing my topic, so hopefully I can get through all my slides in a speedy fashion. As Michael said, we're really interested in understanding the causes of cancer. And when you think about the causes of cancer, there are several things that come to mind. And some of those are mutations, amplifications, deletions of genes that you've probably heard about a lot in some of the previous talks. BRCA1, P53, all of those account for 5 to 10% of the causes of cancer. The other 90 to 95% are environment. And these include things that that you wouldn't necessarily think of when I say environment, lifestyle, sunlight exposure. These there are other topics you're going to hear about. But what is sort of, I guess, disconcerting is that we know, I'm going to try and not wander, sorry. We know way more about the 5 to 10% of the genes and those causes of cancer than we do about the 90 to 95%. And I think this is really well illustrated in this book. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. It's a book called The Emperor of the Maladies, and it's basically the history of cancer. My copy of it has 470 pages, and a grand total of 69 of those are about environment and cancer. And 36 of those are about tobacco. So it doesn't leave much room for the other discussions. So what's happening with those 90 to 95%? We're getting better at understanding, but as Michael said, it's really hard to do this kind of research. Why is that? Because carcinogenesis is difficult to study because it takes so long, and it's even harder to prove. And one of my favorite quotes from this book is the long, slow march of carcinogenesis, because it really takes that long. And unfortunately, in today's funding of cancer research, we sort of get 5 to 7 year blocks if we're lucky, and that's not nearly long enough to study what carcinogenesis is about. So I show this slide because this is the first guy who linked an environmental exposure with a cancer. That, and he has a really cool name. Sir Percival Pott was a physician in London, and he noticed in his practice all of a sudden that he had a bunch of young gentlemen that had scrotal cancer. And what he noticed was that all of these young gentlemen were also working as apprentices in chimney sweeps. And so they were exposed to high levels of tar and soot, and that we now know that those are carcinogenic. But he was the first guy to put a link between what you're exposed to in your environment and the cancer outcome. Unfortunately, it took a long time for this idea to really take up. And the next big leap came when Rachel Carson published The Silent Spring. And I guess this is sort of the environmentalist manifesto. It's also a good read if you haven't read it. What she does is link our environmental exposures, in particular, to bird populations for her, but it really started the entire environmental movement. It started the creation of Environment Canada here, the US EPA. Plus, it really brought home the idea that what we do to our environment can affect us. We can't just be spewing chemicals out. So what is a carcinogen? I just want to take a step back and define it a little more closely, because it becomes important in how we think about it. So consultation of the fountain of all knowledge, the Wikipedia, tells you that it is any substance, radionuclide or radiation, that is an agent that directly causes cancer. True, but I'm going to add some caveats. One is, just as Michael said, we often think that these are synthetic, man-made chemicals. But that's not true. There are lots of natural things that are also carcinogenic, and I'll give you some examples of those. The effects of carcinogens can take a long time. We talked about that. And so it's really hard sometimes to know whether what the inciting agent is, what we call it. What's the thing that actually caused the cancer? If it happened 25 years ago, I don't know, what was I doing 25 years ago? And finally, we're increasingly understanding that an agent doesn't necessarily have to be carcinogenic itself, that it can alter the immune system, and so, or metabolism even. And this will change our risk for developing cancer. Also, it can promote cancer caused by another agent. So it in and of itself isn't carcinogenic, but it helps something else along. So what are the major sources of environmental contaminants? And there are six of them. They're listed in no particular order. The first is industry and manufacturing. And this is sort of what everyone thinks of when we think of environmental pollution, a smokestack with things spewing out into the air. But it's often in the manufacturing process, and when things are manufactured, you often have residues left on them. So as you purchase it, you are exposed to it. The second is agriculture. Agriculture is really big because of the pesticides and the herbicides that we put on the fields to kill the weeds. This has increased significantly since we started using genetically modified crops. Monsanto sells a seed of corn called the Roundup Ready corn. And basically, it has a genetic modification so that it isn't killed when you put the weed killer Roundup on it. So you can put massive amounts of Roundup on your field and just kill the weeds and have your corn left. But it has a little Roundup on it. It's interesting that Monsanto also will sell you the Roundup, but that's a completely different lecture. Another option, I guess, or another part of farming is animal farming. And there's another book called The Omnivore Dilemma by Michael Pollan, if you haven't read it. And he spends a lot of time talking about CAFOs and how we now farm animals, pigs, chickens, cattle, and it's high density. They grow close together. And so in order to do that, you have to give them a lot of antibiotics and some other pharmaceuticals. And so all of this ends up in our environment as well. Our modern lifestyle, obviously, if you're sitting on the Dakary Expressway breathing in all of those toxic fumes, you have a little higher exposure for that day. But it can have all of the things that sort of facilitate what we think of as the ease of modern lifestyle are included in this. I've put the electrical power lines in the picture, but the data for this is less convincing sometimes, but it's possible. The other two are medical exposures and military sources. Medical include things like x-rays, radiation from CT, but we're pretty good at controlling this, and we don't send ourselves through x-ray machines all the time. Bigger for medical sources is pharmaceuticals, unused medicines. What happens when you clean out your medicine cabinet? You open it up and you dump it down the toilet, right? I urge you, if I can stand on a soapbox for 5 seconds, don't do that anymore. Take them back to the pharmacy. Jean Coutu takes them back for sure. I'm sure most of the other ones do. What happens is as you flush that toilet, it goes down into the sewer and directly into the St. Lawrence. And if you look at the major contaminants in the St. Lawrence River, pharmaceuticals is a major problem. So much so that things like birth control pills are causing the feminization or making things look more girly if you're a fish or a bird, and probably humans as well, but there's limited data for that. Another one is military sources, and that's because military personnel around the world like to leave things exactly how they last used them. You'll see a fighter jet there sitting in a swamp. Why? I don't know, but they just sort of left it there. The bottom picture is actually the Gaddafi military base in Libya, where there's a massive store of chemicals that no one really knows what they are. But these kinds of things are pretty frequent by the military. And finally, the natural sources. So Elliot's going to talk about sunlight, so I'm not going to spend time on that. But things like uranium are found naturally in the Earth's crust, and it varies where you live. as it decomposes, it becomes radium and then radon gas. And you can be exposed to that, and we have, most of us have detectors in our house for that. I can't leave the lecture without talking about arsenic, because this is what we spend a lot of time in my lab looking at. Arsenic has gotten a lot of press lately because it's found at high concentrations in some rice products, in baby food, in apple juice. There was a lot of press about it. And it's not regulated in foods. It's regulated in drinking water. The Health Canada tells us that your municipal drinking water can be at 10 parts per billion, no higher. Anyone in the city of Montreal can rest assured, because I've measured it myself, it's way less than that. But if you have a well, the government does not mandate that you clean it out, but you are responsible for your own wells in your chalet. So you are responsible for testing for arsenic and cleaning it out yourself. The government's not going to do that for you. So those are all possibilities of where to get environmental exposures. But you have to keep in mind, just as Michael was saying, tobacco is a huge problem, as a known carcinogen. But there are 43 known carcinogens in one cigarette, and there are many more potential carcinogens. So you're not exposed to one thing at one time. And just because Nicole gave me the podium and I have the clicker, I'm going to tell you about one project that we have going in our lab, because I like talking about research. This is a project that started in Fallon, Nevada. So to orient you on U.S. geography, oops, go back one. Over here, California, L.A., San Francisco, Las Vegas, everyone knows where that is. Up here by Reno is a town called Fallon, and you can see it here as the satellite map. It sits in an agricultural area. Satellite maps, metals look green because they're usually found with some copper. So all of this is metal that's found in the naturally there in the Earth's crust. That's how it's made. Fallon Station is a military airbase. And what was noticed a few years ago was that they had a childhood leukemia cluster. In a five-year span, there were 22 kids that were diagnosed with leukemia. You would, on average, expect one in a town the size of Fallon. There were other tumors. Rhabdomyosarcoma is a rare muscle tumor. There are rare brain tumors, and sort of the general cancer risk is higher there. And I was called in to consult by the EPA, or for the APA, because they have high levels of arsenic. They have probably in their well water 100 times more than what you would say is the maximum contaminant level that Health Canada or the U.S. EPA has set. But arsenic doesn't cause leukemia. So I figured my job was done, and I had a free trip to Reno. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I got to sit there longer, and they asked about other metals. There are six other metals they have high levels of, including cobalt and chromium. There's some evidence that those might be leukemia-causing, but it's not terribly strong. They have high levels of depleted uranium because in Nevada is the site of the nuclear testing. They used a lot of the abandoned mines to test nuclear weapons as they were developing the bombs. So the ground there is a little bit contaminated, just a little bit. DDE is the DDT derivative, as Michael was telling you about, and it's a farming community used as a pesticide. It's banned now, but it's what we call a POP, persistent organopollutant, which means it persists. And so you're sort of stuck with it. And they have JP-8 jet fuel from the military airplace there, all of which could combine to give you the perfect storm. The other thing that's in Fallon is the largest tungsten carbide producer. So they manufacture tungsten carbides. And the tungsten levels there were 15 times higher than the national average. But tungsten's pretty much classified as an inert metal. So, well, what do you know about tungsten, Corin? Well, it took me a day to read everything there is to know about tungsten, which isn't a lot. And so we started on a project to think about whether tungsten could be an important source of environmental pollutant. What are your exposures of tungsten? Tungsten filaments are in light bulbs. Everyone knows the tungsten-based light bulbs. Tungsten rock carbide rods are used because they're super strong and they conduct really well. The DOD in the U.S., the Department of Defense, had the brainstorm idea to green up their bullets. and they replaced the depleted uranium and lead with tungsten in their ammunition. And while they were testing the firing capacity of this, they managed to completely contaminate the Massachusetts military base in Cape Cod because it leached into the water table. But it's inert. It's not a problem. Golf clubs, a lot of everyday uses use alloys, which is a combination of metals. And they're super strong, but light. It's good in a golf club, I'm told. I don't actually golf, but... And finally, they're being more and more incorporated into medical devices. This was a case that I'm consulting with these women in California who were exposed to tungsten during a clinical trial of breast cancer patients. And it left, as they were testing a device, it left residual tungsten in their breasts. And what we did was we scraped the shield just to see what it looked like, what we were looking for. And then when we looked in the breast tissue of the patients, you can see the tungsten pieces here, and it's surrounded by inflammatory response. So clearly the body is reacting to this. Is it harmful? It's unclear. So what have we learned so far about tungsten in my lab? We've learned that tungsten accumulates in our bones, and like the metal lead, it takes a long time to go away. So if you're exposed to it, you're sort of stuck with it for a while. It will eventually go away. Tungsten does cause DNA damage. It does change the immune system. And in models of breast cancer in mice, it enhances the metastasis to the lung. What we don't know is how much tungsten and how long of an exposure it takes for these toxic effects, and whether anything we do in mice is actually applicable to humans, right? So now that I've scared you all is not lost. I don't think that we should live in a bubble. We have to be realistic about our exposures. And you have to know that, as Michael was pointing out, we aren't all walking around with cancer. Our bodies are really good, and we have lots of mechanisms to deal with our exposures. We have natural enzymes that detoxify things and help get rid of them, and so they don't have to sit in our bodies. Not all of them, but we do a pretty good job in general. But this is what I get asked all the time. How do we reduce our cancer risk from environmental exposures? And I'll point you, if you're interested in reading, to this pamphlet. It's more of a large PDF that was put out by the President's Cancer Panel in the U.S. some years ago now, but it's still valid, and you can download it for free. And what they discuss in here are the major sources of contaminant and their recommendations for reducing risk. So I put together what I think are my lists. This is the short but not complete list. And I'll put the caveat in that these are my thoughts and should be held solely responsible for them. On a personal individual level, stop smoking. We've talked about that one already. I think that that's probably not necessarily the easiest thing to do, but it's clear cut. Second, limit bisphenol A or phthalate plastics. These are all labeled, and a lot of people and companies have already removed BPA and phthalates from their plastics, and you can usually just look at the bottom of the bottle and it will tell you. Minimize your consumption of smoked or charbroiled meats. I know this is not a popular idea, considering that it might actually be summer here soon. But that was yesterday. Oh, sorry. We missed it. So you had one day to eat your charcoal broiled steak. I think burning of carbon-based compounds releases things called hydrocarbons, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, if you want to be specific. And what these things do... we don't exactly know. They can be carcinogenic. We use them a lot in rodent models in the lab. But certainly limiting your consumption of these would be good. My thesis advisor used to joke that it was okay to have the charbroiled steak if you had it with a glass of red wine and some chocolate for your antioxidants. I'll leave you with that thought, and you can come up with your own. I think one of the biggest things we can do is reduce our exposure to pesticides by choosing food that is grown in the absence of fertilizers. I purposely didn't say organic, because organic is a term that is a legal term, and things have to be certified to be organic. There are lots of farmers around Montreal. Get to know your growers. There are lots of farmers that are not organic certified, and yet they grow without pesticides, and their food is really good. So if you can limit your pesticide exposure, that would be great. Wash your food properly. Try to buy meats that are antibiotic without antibiotics. Loblaws, IGA, Metro, I'm sure most of them sell it. And as the demand for it gets more, the prices will come down. They already have started. Thinking more globally, and I'm almost done. Thinking more globally. So those are things that you can do to impact yourself. But what can you do to impact the environment? And this gets a little preachy, but again, dispose properly of your pharmaceuticals, but also of your chemicals, your paints, the things that you use in the household. EcoCenter will take care of that for you, your e-waste. Then it doesn't contaminate the soil and the water. You can also choose the non-toxic versions of these, but I urge you to read labels, because being green is a very popular advertising mode at this point, and not all green products are actually that green. So read your labels and see what's actually in the products that you buy. And finally, reduce electricity, and you can read this as fossil fuels if you'd like. Turn off things that you're not using in the summer. Yesterday, you could put your laundry out on the line to dry instead of using the dryer. Take public transit. Keep in mind that this is a list of things that I think we could all do. I'm still a work in progress. I do some of these better than others, but I think it's a mindset more than anything. And finally, I just wanted to leave you with two resources. One is a searchable website that you can use to search by chemical or product. It's a U.S. website, but it works still. Here's products. You can search by manufacturers, ingredients. It's a really great website. You can't really see it that well, but you put in your search, and off you go. You can get some information. The other is a Canadian website that's really exceptionally well done, and it is called the Canadian Environmental Health Atlas. Basically, you can't search by chemical, which is why I put the U.S. website in, but you can search by disease state and by disease, and you can browse a list of what their contaminants are. So I hope I haven't scared everyone to death. I don't think you need to be hyper-vigilant. I just think you need to be aware.
I hope you have an answer.
I do.
Because we never use them.
No, never.
So our third speaker tonight is a good friend of mine. We actually sat when we were young researchers. We are? Oh, good. On a grand panel for many years, actually. And this is where I got to know Elliot and his work. Elliot is coming to us from the University of Montreal, so we reach across the mountain again, and we ask him to come and talk to us about his work. He's going to be talking about stemming the tide of sunlight-associated skin cancer. He's a professor in the Department of Medicine. He has a research laboratory in the research center at Hôpital Maisonneuve-Rosemont. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Nicole. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I'm going to pick up where Corinne left off. She said she's not going to try to scare you to death. I am going to try to scare you to death.
Try to stay. My phone is being taped.
Okay, but I'm afraid of Max. This is a Mac. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to get right to the point. I have my water there.
Okay.
So as you know, we're all waging this war against cancer, and there are many strategies and challenges. The first strategy is to cure cancer, and this is what everyone hopes for, this is what everyone talks about, and books. I'm not very good at that. And currently, what we use to treat cancer is radiotherapy and chemotherapy, which preferentially targets rapidly dividing cancer cells over quiescent cells, or cells that aren't rapidly dividing. But nonetheless, radiotherapy and chemotherapy has devastating side effects on normal cells, even though it targets... Oh, you can't hear? Okay. Sorry, I like to walk around. These agents can also have limited usefulness because patients develop a clinical resistance to them, so eventually they become useless. So much research currently focuses on ways to mitigate these issues. Okay, we can also, another strategy is to inhibit cancer, and as most of you probably know, most cancer deaths are attributable to spreading of the primary tumor to distant sites, which we call metastasis. And many researchers are now attempting to develop novel drugs that effectively inhibit metastasis, which could allow many patients to live long and productive lives, but without curing them, as kind of like diabetes and the use of insulin. Before insulin became available, diabetes was a death sentence, but now people can live for many years, of course, with insulin injections. But of course, this is what everybody is talking about today, and that's the third strategy, which is to prevent cancer. And there are many highly dangerous cancers for which the primary environmental cause is known. And these types of cancers can either be largely prevented, in the case of alcohol and dietary fat, which are primary causes of liver cancer and colon cancer, respectively. If you restrict your intake of alcohol, you're less likely to have liver cancer. I'm not going to live by that because right after this, I'm rushing to my television and I'm going to start drinking beer and watching the Canadians. And also, if you eat way too many McDonald's hamburgers, this increases your risk of colon cancers. But these types of cancers are much more complicated than simply causation by alcohol or dietary fat. Some types of cancers can be virtually completely prevented. And I think you all very well know the example of cigarettes and lung cancer. If cigarettes never existed, lung cancer would be a very, very rare disease. And what I'm going to try to talk to you about today is another type of cancer which can be virtually completely prevented because we know the primary environmental cause. It's absolutely 100% clear. It's natural or artificial sunlight causing both melanoma and non-melanoma skin cancer. And what I'm going to try to do today is a bit different than what other people might be doing. I'm going to try to explain to you how skin cancers develop. We all know that they're caused by solar ultraviolet light. I will explain to you how this happens, and this might give you more insight into why you should avoid sunlight and therefore greatly reduce your risk of developing skin cancer. So skin cancer is the most frequent neoplasm. A neoplasm is any disease which involves aberrant cell growth. So it's the most frequent neoplasm in Caucasian populations, and there's two types. Non-melanoma skin cancer. So in 2013, approximately 82,000 Canadians, and I think NORAD mentioned that there were about 160,000 cancer diagnoses in Canada. So this means that half of all cancers are non-melanoma skin cancers. So approximately 82,000 Canadians were diagnosed with non-melanoma skin cancer, 420 succumbed to the disease. Non-melanoma skin cancer, which comprises two types, basal and squamous cell carcinomas, primarily afflict people over the age of 50, like people myself. Yeah. But they're still obviously very important. Even though it's mostly a disease of the older generation, but it's still extremely frequent. But it is invasive and not metastatic, and generally responds extremely well to treatment. So it's curable. Sorry. I keep doing this, right?
Yep.
Okay, I'll try to stay. Can you nail my feet to the floor or something like that? Okay. Well, I hope it didn't insult anybody there, religious people. Okay. So non-melanoma skin cancer is invasive and not metastatic, so it doesn't spread to distant sites in the body, and it responds very well to treatment. But it can be very aggressive because it recurs very readily. Once you get it, you have a great chance of getting it again. And as such, it's disfiguring due to repeated surgical interventions. And last but not least, non-melanoma skin cancer represents a significant burden on the healthcare system, and God knows we don't need any more burden on the healthcare system. So this is what most people think about when skin cancer comes to light, pardon the pun. And much of what I'm telling you now about the statistics can be seen on the Canadian Cancer Society website. Here's the web address. And the Canadian Cancer Society has a lot of information about skin cancer and the statistics and the treatment modalities. So in 2013, approximately 6,000 Canadians, so considerably less than the non-melanoma skin cancer, were diagnosed with malignant melanoma, but 1,050 of these unfortunate individuals succumbed to the disease. 1 in 63 and 1 in 79 Canadian men and women, respectively, will be diagnosed with malignant melanoma in their lifetime. And 1 in 283 men and 1 out of 479 women will die of the disease. So unfortunately, statistically, there are some among us who this may happen to. So it is a very frequent, malignant melanoma is a very frequent disease. And what's even more alarming, while it comprises only 5% of skin cancers, it is the second leading cause of cancer deaths in young Canadian adults. So malignant melanoma, unlike non-melanoma skin cancer, knows no age. It attacks people of all ages, and it can occur very readily in young people, particularly in this age bracket. So primary melanoma, unless it's diagnosed very early and promptly removed, tends to metastasize extremely aggressively to vital organs, at which point the disease becomes refractory to treatment and becomes extremely serious, and often the patients will succumb. Over the past six decades, the frequency of skin cancer continues to rise, and this includes melanoma as well as non-melanoma skin cancers, and this is an extremely disturbing situation. So I'm going to teach you a bit of basic genetics, because I want to explain to you how, as I mentioned, how skin cancer develops, and I think that it's very important for people to understand. And hopefully, this is all I've thought about for the last 30 years, so I think it's the best thing that I can try to show you. So every cell in our bodies contains 46 individual chromosomes, 23 pairs, and each of these chromosomes consists of a single continuous strand or polymer of DNA with a highly symmetrical helical structure like this. The double helix, I'm sure you've all heard about it. And this is just a very small piece of DNA. As a matter of fact, on this scale, one chromosome would probably be about 1,000 kilometers long if it would be on this scale. So chromosomes, these long continuous strands or polymers of DNA, are comprised of thousands of individual units called genes. And each one of these genes is responsible for making its own protein. And these genetically encoded proteins, as many of you know, define virtually everything about us, including susceptibility to virtually all types of cancer. So I think that something that we've already started to realize during this symposium is that exposure to radiation or chemicals in the environment can induce DNA damage, or what we'll call DNA lesions, in the double helix. And this will disturb the structure of genes in individual cells, which in turn will lead to permanent genetic changes known as mutations. And these mutations can destroy the function of certain genes that we call tumor suppressor genes. And these tumor suppressor genes normally encode proteins that act to protect us against cancer. There's another type of mutation which involves a change rather than destroying the function of certain normal genes, such that they now become what we call oncogenes that have now a new function that is actually to promote cancer development, to make cells grow faster, to make cells proliferate when they normally are not supposed to. So I think, as has been mentioned by Corin, at least 90% of human cancers arise due to environmentally caused mutations, and these occur largely in oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes. And these mutations occur randomly and accumulate in single cells, as was mentioned earlier. So every cell in our body is a potential cancer. And at some point, this single quiescent cell, once it accumulates enough of these mutations in tumor suppressor genes and oncogenes, will start to grow uncontrollably into a full-blown metastatic tumor, which is pretty scary, I think. So I think perhaps you may have some idea. I mean, I'm not a physicist. I'm a photobiologist, but I think probably we all have an inkling that virtually all of the energy, all of the radiation on the surface of the Earth originates from the sun. Some of it comes from outer space, but 99.99999% originates from the sun. And all of the energy is part of what we call the electromagnetic spectrum. So this electromagnetic spectrum goes from high-energy, short-wave wavelength radiation, like X-rays. And X-rays, you know, are used extensively in cancer diagnosis and cancer treatment. But they're also, of course, cancer-causing. Then we have, on the other extreme of the electromagnetic spectrum, we have low-energy, very long-wavelength radiation. And interestingly, there's a similarity between these two in terms of their biological effects, although for very different reasons. Low-energy, long-wavelength radiation, which are radio waves and microwaves and cell phone waves, et cetera, are definitely very useful in cancer diagnosis, like in MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging. It's also becoming obvious that these types of radiation may be useful in cancer treatment. And of course, everybody is afraid of getting brain cancer from their cell phone, which is a possibility. And I don't want to scare you, but I know I am. But these types of radiations can cause cancer, and there's a lot of ongoing research. But what we're going to talk about today is one portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, ultraviolet radiation, which is split up into three regions, which have very different biological effects, as I'll tell you in a moment. Ultraviolet C, fortunately, which is the most dangerous, is completely blocked by the ozone layer. However, the UVB and UVA, most of the UVB gets through. A little bit of it is blocked by ozone. And all of the UVA gets through the ozone layer. And these types of radiation are, of course, what are well known to cause skin cancer. So I'm going to get right to the point, and I'm going to tell you that solar UVB severely damages DNA directly. So here you have this beautiful DNA helix, which has this very, this symmetrical, beautiful symmetrical structure that I showed you before. And then this is a piece of DNA in one of your skin cells. You expose yourself to UV. The incoming UVB photon, a photon is a package of UVB light, we call them photons, is directly absorbed by the DNA. And this causes a DNA lesion. This DNA lesion distorts the structure of DNA. You don't want your DNA to be structurally distorted, believe me. And this structural distortion will lead to a high frequency of genetic mutations. And for this reason, because ultraviolet B is an extremely powerful mutagen that distorts the DNA structure, is highly mutagenic, UVB is the preeminent cause of skin cancer, of this disease that afflicts almost 100,000 people in Canada. And these extremely dangerous lesions, when you sit in the sun during the peak hours from 11 o'clock until 2 o'clock in the afternoon without any protection, you will get approximately, the average person, depending on skin color, will get 100,000 of these lesions per skin cell. And that is alarming. That is a lot. These DNA lesions, every time the skin cell divides, and skin cells do tend to divide, the ones that get cancer, they're in the basal layer of the epidermis, which is actively dividing. Every time it divides, there's a chance, a good chance, that this one of these 100,000 UVB-induced DNA lesions will become a mutation, perhaps in an oncogene or a tumor suppressor gene, that will contribute to cancer development. 5 minutes? You're kidding. Okay, so, all right, so then okay, so I can't go through this, okay? It's okay. No, fortunately, given that we have that ultraviolet B-induced DNA damage is so dangerous, there is a mechanism. No, I can make this fast. Don't worry. There's a mechanism, and this is what I've been studying for many years, called nucleotide excision repair. And what nucleotide excision repair does is once a DNA lesion is induced, here this little red thing, I was going to explain it. It's really beautiful. But anyways, you have undamaged DNA. It sustains DNA damage. And you have this incredible mechanism, I wish I could tell you about it, which will completely restore the DNA to its normal form. It will remove this DNA lesion, and it will restore the integrity of the DNA completely. This pathway is the only pathway in humans for removing UVB-induced DNA damage. Okay, now what about solar UVA? Solar UVA does not damage DNA directly. It's only very poorly absorbed by DNA relative to UVB. It kind of bounces off DNA, whereas UVB is strongly absorbed. Therefore, UVA is much, much less, 50,000-fold less mutagenic than UVB. So in direct comparison with UVB, so at equal doses of energy, UVA is much, much less carcinogenic, but it is a strong pro-oxidant, so it generates a lot of oxygen-free radicals, which indirectly damage DNA and many other cellular components. Therefore, UVA does contribute to skin cancer development, although it's still not entirely clear how and to which extent, unlike the case for UVB. And UVA is also definitely the primary environmental determinant in wrinkling and aging of the skin. I'm sure some of you may be interested to know that. Okay, so how does... I will be finished soon, don't worry, don't panic. I have lots of slides, but I will be finished soon. So how does highly mutagenic solar UV cause cancer, in summary? Ultraviolet light is a complete carcinogen. So in precisely the same manner as cigarette smoking appears to be necessary and sufficient to cause a majority of lung cancers, so too the sunlight exposure by itself alone underlie most skin cancers. So what happens, in summary, is that here you have the sun. The sun emits highly mutagenic UVB rays. It induces mutations in oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes. Oncogene mutations will accumulate, leading to abnormal cellular proliferation. Tumor suppressor genes, on the other hand, when they're mutated, confer defects in the repair of DNA, like the mechanism nucleotide excision repair I just mentioned. There are also other protective processes which are rendered defective by mutations in tumor suppressor genes. And then most people will continue to expose themselves to the sun. This will cause more cancer-causing mutations and eventually lead to skin cancer. Now, I just want to tell you a bit about a disease called xerodermapigmentosum. And this will strongly emphasize how dangerous ultraviolet light is. This is a rare genetic disorder characterized by congenital mutations, meaning that they occur at birth. And these are mutations in nucleotide excision repair pathway genes. So So these patients are defective in the, in repairing UVB-induced DNA damage. They're profoundly incapacitated in the removal of these lesions. And these individuals are generally normal, except for acute photosensitivity. As you can see, here's a child, 9 months old. Is the first, very first time, this is the very first time he went in the sun for about 3 minutes. And this is the result, 3 minutes. This is a young girl with a mutation in the nucleotide excision repair pathway, 2 years old. And normally she has a lot of precancerous lesions, we call it thinning keratoses, and some actual basal cell carcinoma on her lip. And this young girl, these are cancers that are normally sustained by individuals in their 60s and 70s. So these patients have a 10,000-fold increased risk of developing both non-melanoma skin cancer and malignant melanoma. And this underscores the powerful mutagenic and carcinogenic properties of UVB and the importance of efficient UVB lesion repair in preventing skin cancer. So I think I have a lot more to say. Time flies. Okay. I'll move to the next one. This is my first public lecture. So I hope that... questions like I was going to talk a little bit about things like vitamin D and sunscreens and all this type of thing. So you may be interested to ask me questions about that, and I know something about it because, again, I've been thinking about it for 30 years. So I might have something important to say. Stay out of the sun. Absolutely.
Thank you, Elliot. You'll learn.
Yes.
So it's our great pleasure tonight to welcome our fourth and last speaker, Dr. Robert Kilgore, who is a professor in the Department of Exercise Science at Concordia University. So now we reach out to the West. And he's Associate Director here at McGill Nutrition and Performance Laboratory. It's a great pleasure to have you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nicole, and I'd like to thank the Goldman family for this lovely lecture series and for inviting me to come and speak to you this evening. When I was talking to Nicole earlier, I said that there's always a hazard of being the last speaker of a four-speaker panel, especially on tonight, which most people in this city is calling the eve of the fourth game of the series, or the fifth game of the series, I should say. And this is only understandable for people in the area of Montreal. And if I definitely go beyond 8 o'clock and I know that I'm going to be speaking to empty seats only, I know where you'll be. So I thank you for attending this evening's lecture. And I'm really pleased to be talking to you about prevention and the role that exercise can play and physical activity can play in the role of exercise prevention. In cancer prevention, I'm sorry. So my presentation outline is going to be somewhat brief, and I'm hoping that to be stuck right on the 20-minute time period that we have been given. Starting off with physical activity and cancer risk, and then defining the role of physical activity within cancer as well, and looking at these very key central issues when it comes down to exercise. So the big question that I'm always asked, and it's a very simple question, but one that is very complex, so number one is physical activity important for people with cancer? Is it important? And if it is, how important is it? And how relevant is it? Should we be doing it? Well, that's like asking about motherhood and apple pie. Should we be doing it? Yes, we should. But what is the significance of us doing the activity? And what intensity of activity should actually we be doing? So in terms of trying to accumulate all of the research data that is now given to us, and I can tell you back in 1976 when there was one publication, one in 1976 that talked about cancer risk and exercise. And that has developed greatly since 2010 to the present day, where we have close to 750 published studies talking about cancer risk reduction and exercise. And just this year alone, as of yesterday, there were 115 publications just on that particular topic. So the topic is starting to gain national and international prevalence, and lots of people are starting to know and want to know more about physical activity. So what I have done, I've taken one landmark paper published by Christine Friedenreich, who works at the Cancer Institute in Cancer Cross Institute in University of Alberta. And what she did back in 2010 is that she grouped a number of cancers where they have shown modifiable types of changes with respect to exercise. And so I'm going to try to group them rather than going through the hundreds of studies that she talked about, but just to group them in a certain category so that you can have some understanding. And I put down in the middle the risk reduction. So if I'll just go through the first one with you. Here are the colon cancer studies, of which she grouped 60 colon cancer studies looking at the influence of exercise and colon cancer prevention, and found that overall there is a risk reduction of 20 to 25% with respect to exercise influence on reducing the risk of people getting colon cancer. So if you look at this table in that respect, you can see that in terms of the breast cancer studies, 73 studies that were accumulated up till 2010, and there was up to a 25% risk reduction. And endometrial cancers, the variety of endometrial cancers that we do see, in terms of the 20 studies there, somewhere around 20 to 30% in terms of risk reduction. And I put down just some comments along the side there just to put in some very specific markers of some of the findings that we have seen with respect to these studies. So in terms of the comments on the first, 30 to 60 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity is required in order to get this reduction to occur. And I'll speak to you about what we mean by moderate to vigorous levels of activity and what they could actually mean, because I think you'll be surprised in terms of what you can do to really limit your risk, and that you don't have to go bouncing around in a gymnasium setting to loud music to try to get this to happen. 75% found to reduce risk of these studies when compared to the least active group, and the active group for the 50-year-olds had a stronger effect of risk, meaning that the older that these people had, they had even a better risk recovery from doing physical activity interventions. There was no pattern on any of the hormone receptor status, and when we look at the 4 to 7 hours per week of moderate to vigorous activity, this was on average from the 73 studies that were found, so that you don't have to exercise for 7 to 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, in order to get this kind of benefit or this kind of an effect. One last one here that I'd like to show you with endometrial cancer. Dose response is in 50% of the studies. The higher intensity showed a greater protection. And you'll see this in several of the studies, that the more intense you work out in terms of the intensity of the exercise, that offers you a better risk reduction and better protection. A caveat here. It doesn't work with all cancers, but with some it does. Okay. And one thing that I'd like to point out, even though these people exercise for 1 hour per day, which was supposed to be protective in nature, the researchers also found that there was the risk started to rise again when you sat more than 5 hours per day. So if you think that you have complete protection from exercising your 1 hour a day, and then you go home and you watch 8 hours of television, that is going to actually start to reverse your risk protection. So it tells you that in addition to your exercise that you're doing every day, that you should make some commitment to do some type of general activity during the course of the day. I'm not talking about 8 hours of activity. I'm talking about just more movement other than just sitting down watching television. And these are pretty good. In terms of epidemiological evidence that we call possible, lung studies, 20 of them, 20 to 40% reduction. Prostate, 15 studies, 10 to 20%. Ovarian cancer can go as high as 20%. So these are some of the, and these are possible types of discoveries. the ones that I showed you on the previous slide, we're fairly convinced that physical activity can really give you this type of a protection in those cancers. Then, of course, we come to many other cancers where, unfortunately, there is little or no evidence with respect to the success that exercise would have. It doesn't mean that the people who have these cancers aren't exercising. It means that we just don't see right now the benefit of exercise in these particular cancers. And the ideas there are relatively unknown. But there is hope, because what I'm going to show you next is a study done back in 2006 that was the landmark study, really, when it came down to exercise and exercise intervention and in terms of the risk reduction. I'm taking this because this was a landmark study published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, and it really was the best and most well-controlled study of its time. So not saying that everything before 2006 wasn't anything to look at, but this was the really good controlled study. And what I'm doing, I'm taking one important finding from that study. And even though you look at these categories and you look at these definitions of activity, which I'll explain to you in a few moments, I think you can understand that this level of activity is very minimal, this level of activity is moderate, and this level of activity is vigorous. And when you look at, we call these hazard ratios, the lower the hazard ratio, the greater protection that you get from this type of activity. So this is my translation of this data to you. So the more vigorous the activity was, the better protection was given to these types of people who suffered from colorectal cancer. Okay, colorectal cancer. Now, the other studies that are coming up from 2014, that is this year. So this is hot off the press. Now, I'm not going to go over all of the small print here. What I've done is that there have been studies, there's a recent study looking at gastroesophageal cancer in particular, and looking at exercise, and is there a risk reduction with exercise for people that have gastroesophageal cancer? And in this particular study, it shows that there is up to a 33% reduction, okay, in the incidence and risk of having gastroesophageal cancer. Gastric cancers, risk 19 to 22%. Okay? Brain cancer, okay? Brand new study looking at this, a relative risk reduction of 42%. This was a very interesting study because this study came from a fairly large cohort of people who were fairly fit, okay, and did a lot of walking and a lot of running at various intensities. And they found that even though they were that healthy, there was always going to be a cohort that was going to get some form of a brain cancer. And they found that those people that were highly fit and maintained their fitness levels, okay, that they had a relative decrease in risk of getting a brain cancer. Those in the control group who did very little activity were on the high end of getting this type of a cancer. Okay, and same with kidney cancer, relative risk, 61 to 76% reduction in the incidence of this. So exercise nowadays, looking at the 2014 data, and looking at all of my colleagues and researchers who are doing more types of studies in the other areas of cancer other than breast cancer, other than colorectal cancer, other than the breast cancer, other than the well-known cancers, we're seeing now in some of the least known cancers, but the highly high and the deadly cancers, that there seems to be some offering of protection for those people who embark and engage upon some type of physical activity. So there were some of these weren't really conclusions. They were conclusions from observations made by Christine Friedenreich and by Kolditz way back in the late 1990s. And I'm going to let you read that because these clinical epidemiologists have a very interesting way of really hitting home, you know, the importance of what they were studying. And so with this, you can see that several hundred thousand people could have avoided having a certain form of cancer if they decided to embark upon some form of physical activity. And this was a classic European study done back in 2010. And here, lastly, with Kolditz, looking at the United States, if everybody increased their amount of activity by 3 hours per day, everybody in the United States, that there'll be a general reduction of 17% in cancer occurrences. Okay, so these types of statements and numbers really hit home about the importance of exercise with respect to reduction of risk in terms of getting cancer. So I'm not going to go into a lot of the mechanisms, but what are the factors that can explain the protective effect of physical activity in reducing cancer risk in particular individuals? Well, it's really hard to look at what the effects of exercise is doing, but we sure know what the effect of inactivity is doing. And so when we are more inactive, what do we normally find? We find that our body composition starts to increase, and it's not our muscle mass that's increasing when we're inactive. Okay? It's more of the fat mass that's starting to increase. And this is a very strong bit of evidence. Body composition, insulin resistance, and inflammation are the top three main observations, mechanisms that can actually contribute, okay, to the overall biology of what's going on in the body as to why people are getting the cancers, because they usually are overweight. They usually have some low-grade, low-level inflammation. Okay? They generally have insulin resistance. Okay, and so those are the top three. Now, we know with exercise, you can lose body fat and gain muscle mass. And that increase in muscle mass can help you with your insulin resistance. It can improve your insulin resistance. Okay, you can also have a decrease in the low-grade inflammation as well. So we know what happens with inactivity, and we suspect that exercise is going to be positive in terms of reversing those factors that cause these effects of or these mechanisms related to the cancer development. Defining the role of exercise now. Well, what's the optimum dose? And a long time ago, I didn't know how to describe, especially to a clinical population or a population interested in hearing about medicine. So when you start talking about exercises, dosages, it's like taking your exercise pill during the course of the day. All right? And so what's your exercise pill in terms of the intensity, the duration, and the frequency of activity that you need to do in order to protect yourself, okay, from getting some of these cancers? Well, we have to go to the basic value. The basic value is called the MET, the metabolic equivalent of task. And the way that you should understand the MET and the definition, everybody here sitting down, rather calm, rather quiet, the game hasn't started yet, and if somebody gets up and starts clapping for something that I think I've said, it's probably because the Canadians have scored, but you're rather quiet right now, so you are expending, in terms of your energy, one MET. One MET. So congratulations, you're all expending that much energy right now. All right? So in terms of the guidelines, our current public health guidelines, this is the MET level that we expect you to have over the course of the week. 10 MET hours per week. What I have done in terms of to translate that term for you, here's what an example of 10 MET hours per week looks like. So 30 minutes per day, 5 days a week, of brisk walking. And they say, well, brisk walking, the walking level is 4 METs. That is 4 times the energy expenditure that you are using right now. So that's how you would look at the walk. Nothing terribly, terribly drastic about that. Okay? They call that a brisk walk. And that is, by the public health authorities, this is the current level of guidelines, and this is what we would like to have everybody do in terms of their weekly energy expenditure. Unfortunately, less than 25% of the Canadians are doing that level. Okay? So if 25% of the Canadians are doing less than the recommended allowances of 10 net hours per week, then somebody who has cancer is probably going to be doing less. Okay? So here's what we're looking at in terms of some type of activity. What's the optimum dose for good health? Well, I've given you 2 examples here. Moderate activity, 5 days a week, 30 minutes per day. That's 150 minutes of activity per week. Brisk walking could satisfy that. 4 METs. At 600 METs minutes or 10 METs hours per week. So this is all that we're asking people to do. There's no running. There's no weight training. There's no sprinting. There's no rope skipping. There's no jumping off of things. There's no jumping around things. Simple walking would do it, but at a brisk rate of activity. Okay? Not light. All right? So what would you say? What's light activity? Well, the first is, which I don't think anybody's doing right now, because of the level of excitement that's about to happen in this city overnight, that 0.09, okay, or 0.9 is very low activity. Watching television, typing at your desk, okay, walking 1.7 miles per hour, walking 2.5 miles per hour. All these values are really very light in terms of their intensity, okay? And this falls out of the recommended dosage range, okay? But the research is very interesting now in looking at the 65-plus crowd. The 65-plus crowd seems to be getting some benefit by doing activity in this range, okay? And that's been seen for people who are 65 and over who have other comorbidities. For instance, 65 and over, and they may have cancer plus diabetes, cancer plus stroke, so that their chance of dying is probably 2 to 3 times higher than the regular population. But the people who have these comorbidities and are exercising, the reduction in the chance of dying goes down by 80%. 80%, not 8, 80%. And it could be simple walking, casual walking, okay? And then you have your moderate intensity ones. And it's going to be these types of descriptors in here that that the recommended allowance is going to be really focusing in on, all right? And then if you go to the very vigorous ones, I'm sure there are people in this room that are vigorous exercisers and need that type of vigor in order to satisfy the psychology of their day, okay? And so we're looking at people who are actually running on the spot, 8 METs, that's 8 times their normal resting metabolic rate, 10 METs, okay, rope skipping. I don't know if anybody's done rope skipping in a while, but if you've ever remembered in your youth doing rope skipping, you don't usually do rope skipping for more than a minute or so. And so there's a limited amount of use for that, but it just tells you the intensity at which these things are doing. So what are the benefits? I've talked to you about what the numbers are, so what are the benefits? Well, clearly, in terms of benefits of regular exercise in cancer patients, people who have cancer already, symptom relief, decrease in inflammatory markers, these are very strong in terms of the findings, in terms of the quality of evidence. Improve treatment tolerance. We find that patients who are having to undergo chemotherapy and any other types of chemical, biological interventions, that they seem to be a better patient. They can take the drugs better in terms of that. So you can see counter deconditioning, reduce cancer reoccurrence, improve survival. Okay, these have all been shown, okay, with respect to the exercise literature and people who have cancer. Okay, clearly people who have cancer and another comorbidity, exercise has been shown to help these individuals greatly. And that's happening more and more as cancer becomes a very treatable disease, that you are living with cancer. It's just like you're living with heart disease. It's like you're living with diabetes. Okay, so cancer is another long-term disease where exercise at this point in time can become a very good intervention. Benefits, increase in activities of daily living, okay? Reduction in the loss of muscle mass. Okay, we know the importance of muscle mass. Minimizing the effects of increased fat mass, okay? Increased survivorship. Challenges, well, with exercise there's always challenge, no matter what exercise you do. Because I've stopped asking people, can I have just a show of hands of how many people actually exercise today according to the public health guidelines? I don't know. You don't have to put up your hands. Yes, one hand went up. Good. Proud of it. 2 hands, 3 hands, 4. Oh, my goodness. I should bring that question back into my repertoire and ask again. Very good. Congratulations to the less than 25% of the crowd that put up their hand. So what are the effects? Here they are. Cancer-related fatigue. These are the challenges for people who do have cancer, and we're asking these people to exercise to either try to reduce their symptomology, or if they have had a cancer cure and they want to be in remission, these are the effects. of being in the remission. Okay, and perhaps one of the last and most difficult one is the low motivation and the self-confidence in terms of wanting to do the exercise. So my take-home message for you tonight. Okay. There's significant reduction in breast, colon, lung cancer risk resulting from low to moderate types of exercise and physical activity. The optimum levels of physical activity is around 10 net hours per week. Okay. And it appears to provide the greatest types of protection. Okay. Some greater intensities could provide greater protection in some cancers, as I said. And lastly, the lower levels of physical activity may be beneficial, especially to those who are 65 and older and who suffer from other comorbidities, cancer and some other, so that the lower intensities of exercise may help these people. Okay. So I thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so you have some little cue cards where you can fill in the questions. We'll have some volunteers go up and down the aisles and collect those questions. And I'd ask the speakers maybe to come to the front table. You'll be able to use the microphones there. And so while the questions are coming down, I'm going to take advantage of my position and ask one question that hasn't been dealt with, and I may put you on the spot. So we've heard about a number of causes: tobacco, carcinogens, UV lights, radiation. We've heard about exercise. What about stress, after all? Our lives are not complicated at all. We're not stressed. Can anyone give me an answer? How important is stress in developing cancer or progression of cancer?
Okay, I'll take that one on. Stress is absolutely unimportant in cancer risk. There is no relationship between stress and cancer. I have many patients who are wealthy, stress-free, beautiful families, have lives that you'd all be jealous of, and they get cancer. There's a very big hazard here, and I like the opportunity to make a point. All the discussion of cancer prevention and risk reduction carries with it an unexpected hazard. And this is very important, and I've seen it. The implication is that if cancer prevention strategies were perfect, that a certain number of cancer patients really, you know, feel guilt for getting cancer because they actually would regard it as their fault. And, you know, this is very unfortunate. There are some situations, like a heavy smoker getting lung cancer, where that line of reasoning does make sense. But notwithstanding everything that you have heard tonight about all the preventative things that we can do, the fact is we have to come down to earth and be realistic. Many cancers cannot be prevented. Many cancers occur in people who are not exposed to known environmental risks, have perfect lifestyles, don't smoke, and still get cancer. So, you know, if one misunderstands the agenda of cancer prevention, every diagnosed patient with cancer would feel guilty that they kind of failed to do something that they could have done to prevent the cancer. And that's absolutely not true. There's always going to be a substantial number of cancers that we cannot actually blame the patient for some kind of omission that led to their diagnosis. Because if that was the case, it causes on top of coping with all the stress of the cancer, it actually creates individual stress, you know, of a different nature at a time when the patients are quite vulnerable. So what I'm saying is that we have to do everything we can, and you've heard a lot of strategies about minimizing cancer risk. And if everybody would do that, as was stated at the very beginning, we would reduce cancer incidence by something like a quarter or a third, which is very, very important and very worthwhile. But it's a third. It's not by 100%. We cannot eliminate cancer today by even perfect application of all known prevention strategies. So we don't want to blame cancer patients for getting their disease.
Okay. Elliot, you have been heard. Everyone wants to hear about vitamin D.
What is it you want to hear about vitamin D? What do you mean by how much? Is this working?
What type of sunscreen?
Oh.
Check.
Okay. Hello? Okay.
Sunblockers.
Yes?
Yes. Vitamin D.
Okay. I can say this much about vitamin D. Vitamin D supplementation substitutes perfectly for sunlight exposure. So although exposure to ultraviolet B is a natural way to have the body manufacture vitamin D, that would require, for example, maybe 10 minutes exposure at 10 a.m. in the morning, just your face and your hands, essentially, which is quite minimal. It is absolutely false that lying in the sun for long periods of time will produce more vitamin D, thereby protecting you against sunlight. Vitamin D does have putative anti-carcinogenic properties, so there are quite a few studies that show that vitamin D signaling could be cancer preventative, but this is not proven. So, but in any case, vitamin D is important to maintain bone health. And if you can't expose yourself to the sunlight in the winter, which most of us cannot, vitamin D supplementation is perfectly fine. You'll have to go to the Health Canada website to find out how many units. I don't know exactly how many, but you can find that easily, for example, at the Health Canada website, what the recommended daily intake of vitamin D is. You can take it on its own. In my opinion, now this is purely my opinion, vitamin supplementation in general, dietary antioxidants play no role, protective role whatsoever against the development of cancer. Okay. That's my opinion, and I think a lot of studies are starting to show that.
There's great synergy in some of your questions, so obviously you've listened. Again, for you, has the sun changed? Is there a difference between the sun in North America versus the sun in the Mediterranean? Has the sun rays changed, or is it our environmental pollutants that have sort of dispersed the ozone layer?
I did my postdoctoral studies in Paris, and there was so much smog there that I don't think I think it's impossible to get a suntan. the atmosphere does, and certainly the ozone layer, you've heard a lot about the ozone layer thinning. The ozone layer blocks a lot of the dangerous, completely blocks the very dangerous portion of the ultraviolet spectrum. All of the UVC, which is extremely dangerous, and a lot of the UVB, and it's the thinning of the ozone layer due to pollution, human pollution caused by human industry, that is contributing, that is causing the change in the sun. The sun itself isn't changing, fortunately. That would be scenario for a science fiction movie, which would be the end of the world.
There's a number of questions about sunblockers, sun tanning lotions, with, without titanium. You know, can you sort of give us a brief summary about that?
Okay, a sun block with SPF 25 is all you need. Anything that's more than that, a sun block, for example, that contains titanium oxide, unless you're climbing Mount Everest, you should put that on your nose and your lips. But titanium oxide, there's no point in using that. Anything 25 is blocks 99.99% of ultraviolet light incident upon your skin. So that's what's recommended, would be 25. Anything less than that, and you're starting, if you use an SPF 2, it hardly does anything.
A very pertinent question for both Michael and maybe Dr. Bob. Can people who carry cancer live a normal life for as long as possible? Is it a way to get rid of the cancer?
Well, that question is an important question. It's not really a cancer prevention question. It's a question of living with cancer, if I understand it correctly. And so it's a little off topic, but it's still an important question, which I'll answer. And yes, in many cases, progress in cancer treatment results in the conversion of cancer diagnosis from a fatal disease to a chronic disease. So some people live for very long with, in many cases, just minor inconveniences. They never can say that they're cured, but you know, their cancer becomes like high blood pressure or diabetes. There's many diseases that are controlled and not cured. And so some cancer patients find themselves living in that context. And that's not quite as satisfying as a cure, but we're very happy when we achieve that. You know, people fear diabetes a little bit less than they fear cancer, because although diabetes is an inconvenience, and it has long-term health consequences, and it does affect long-term lifespan, it still is something where you can have a 10-year agenda and not a 10-week agenda. So, yes, the answer to the question is that we more and more are seeing that some of our patients actually can live with cancer.
Okay, a quick series of associations and quick answers. Caffeine and cancer.
Protective, very little. In other words, don't worry about coffee or tea. Some people would claim it actually is slightly protective. I'm not convinced, but I am convinced it's not carcinogenic. So it will probably do nothing to your cancer risk.
I would like to add to that that people who do cancer research like myself need to be kept awake. And coffee is essential for that.
Secondary tobacco smoke, in particular when there are small children around.
Very bad.
Corin, would you suggest removing skin from fruit like apples to reduce ingesting pesticides?
No, because the skin has a lot of the fiber, and that's going to be good for your diet. I suggest that you wash them. There are actual vegetable and fruit type soaps that you can buy at the grocery store. Normally, I mean, if it's a waxy, for example, cucumbers, the normal cucumbers, honestly, I'd probably peel mine because I don't like eating the outside. But if you washed it and with a waxy buildup like that, you want to use a soap. But for most of the pesticides that are used out there, they're water soluble, so you can rinse. Things like bananas, where you're not going to eat the skin anyway, don't worry about it.
Okay. This one is dear to my heart. Should smoked salmon be reduced in consumption?
a moderate reduction, I would say.
Good.
I would say a big reduction is smoked meat.
Yeah. Yeah. Smoked salmon.
Because actually some of the preservatives in
well, all charcuterie, you know, is I would say is a point was made about barbecuing. That's dangerous, but actually the preservatives, anything that you find a meat that's not refrigerated, if they sell you some kind of, beef jerky or something that is actually meat that for some reason does not go bad. There's something in there that is doing that, and I wouldn't recommend it.
Impact of makeup and nail and hair products in small doses.
So this is a topic that's gotten a lot of press lately on what is in makeup and what those chemicals can be doing. Again, I think read your labels. I think that for a lot of these things, they're a dermatologic exposure, so it's on your skin. Maybe Elliot won't contradict me, but I think it's probably less important, and we have less information on it. Honestly, there's just a lot of less information on what those chemicals do. Read your labels, and if you can, try and find chemical or makeup that's less chemically enriched.
Many dental prostheses are made from chrome cobalt. Has a study been done on this alloy? And what about titanium implants in teeth and hip and knees?
Yeah, so we now no longer use a lot of those implants in teeth and the fillings. We tend to use composites because the metals in there were thought to be somewhat toxic. It's unclear the concentration or the length of exposure that you need to those, but we have replaced the metal use in the filling. They're mostly composite now.
Actually, one other point, if money is no object, one kind of safe metal dental prosthesis is gold.
Yep.
Gold really is, I stand to be corrected, but gold is inert. It certainly is safe, and it's not aesthetically nice to have, gold teeth, but it's probably safe.
It's also a question of dose. I mean, in toxicology, everything is a question of dose. Everything is a poison. That's the basic tenet of toxicology. Water, too much of it, you drown. Too little of it, you just dehydrate. But it's the same for every compound there is. And so my guess is, although I'm not an expert in dental prostheses, is that your dose from those, the wear and tear of that is minimal.
Elliot, or anyone, I guess, does polyester clothing protect skin? Which is best, light or dark colors?
Polyester? I would think that polyester, I'm guessing, would protect you from UV completely. Yeah. Any tight weaved clothing would protect you. It's a matter of how tightly woven it is. As long as the holes are, there can't be no holes, but it has to be tightly woven. Yeah. And there is clothing that's specifically made to block the sun, and that's what people should probably wear at the beach.
More questions on chemicals. Fluoride in water, chlorine in water, colloidal silver.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, let's see. So chlorinated water, it's a big controversy, actually, on whether or not you should have chlorine or fluoride, I assume is going to come up in drinking water. It's unclear what the risks are because we haven't been doing it long enough. But as a swimming in a chlorine chlorinated pool is probably not a huge risk. There's no evidence that drinking chlorinated water is an increased risk. What was the other one? Sorry.
Colloidal silver?
Colloidal silver. I have to say I don't know of any data on colloidal silver, but that doesn't mean there isn't any out there.
Dr. Bob, sorry, I can't. Can you exercise too much?
I'll say yes to that. You can, but on a more serious note, there are people that are around that are trying to really outdo themselves in terms of what they should be doing. And I know that when I was talking about the moderate to less vigorous type of activity being optimum, that's probably best for the large population of people. And there are people that will always try to go one step higher and become more vigorous in their activity. And as a result of going more vigorous in their activity, then they become injured. Hmm. And as they become injured, then all of a sudden they stop their activity, obviously, and they have to recover. So there is some truth to that sense.
Another person in the audience wants to know, what is the best environment for doing exercise? Is it better to be inside and safe or outside and polluted?
You could be inside and polluted as well.
Yeah, probably.
But you know, I'm sure that you can find places outside to do your activity without having to inhale all the carcinogens that are on the corner of St. Catherine and Guy. Absolutely. And inside, obviously, you're safer. I was thought the question was going more towards, you know, the environment in terms of the heat load, the heat stress, which has been shown to be very, very negative, especially for the elderly and especially for people who are more susceptible to disease, because being heat loaded and becoming more dehydrated is just terrible.
Remember that the biggest thing that you've heard about exercise is to actually do it. And so everything is about convenience. So I'll tell you my story. I mean, I joined an exercise club, and the biggest exercise that actually took place in my thing was signing the checks. So I quit the exercise club because it just wasn't convenient enough and I didn't use it. But lots of people now are getting little exercise devices that they can use while they do things like watching television or working at a desk, like a stationary bicycle, something that is in your workplace. We're sedentary often for reasons, and if you can find something that you can do with your body while you're actually doing what makes you sedentary, that's very good. Now, I tried to take out a patent on a certain device that would actually allow you to ride on a stationary bike and watch TV, and when you fell below your target, the TV would turn off. The problem was that it was already patented.
This is also, I think, an important question. We know about the nicotine and all the smoking products, and we know it's highly addictive, and it's well known, it's been publicized, and we all know it's essentially a cause, or at least smoking is a cause of cancer. What is being done at the policy level, whether here by the center, and we're not that well, you're the director, or by government? Is there anything actually happening to reduce the nicotine level that addicts people to smoking?
No. This actually turns out to be a story of politics and evil and not a scientific story. They're actually, you know, the tobacco companies are trying to breed tobacco plants that have increased nicotine to facilitate addicting young people. The United States government blocked the United Nations initiative to stop tobacco exports to the third world. So there's lots of, you know, this transcends science and gets into politics, and the politics are not very nice. The sad part is we are here you know, telling you certain facts, but there are people who go to work every day and their job is to increase tobacco usage.
One other thing on that comment is that maybe not so much in Canada yet, but it's going to come because it's all over the U.S., is the use of e-cigarettes.
Yes.
And I will add the comment that I was just at a toxicology meeting where there is increased risk of cancer due to e-cigarettes. They are not better.
But data doesn't show yet whether it's worse than our tobacco risk, right? It's too new.
It's too early, yeah. But the components of it are still carcinogenic.
I think that the tobacco use has been reduced dramatically. I think that's a big success. I think that the next target, and I'm not really joking, should be Tim Hortons donuts. I'm not joking about that. Not only Tim Hortons donuts, all donuts.
Yeah.
Or Krispy Kremes, whatever.
Yeah.
In our hospital, we outlawed Tim Hortons.
Michael, someone would like to know if you foresee the opening of a cancer prevention clinic, and how can people differentiate between good and bad advice?
Well, there's nothing magic about cancer prevention and advice, whether you're going to buy a car or a house or prevent cancer, or, you know, there is good advice and there's bad advice on all topics. And so, you know, you have to actually be an intelligent consumer. There is a necessity for people to advocate for themselves. I mean, there is lots of examples of reputable websites and non-reputable websites. Be careful of websites that you usually can tell. There's a few tests for bad advice. If the advice costs money, it's probably bad. And if the advice promises something that is unreasonable, like, you know, buy our supplement and you'll never get cancer, you know, that's suspicious. With respect to a cancer prevention clinic, we do have a cancer prevention clinic at the Siegel Cancer Center, the Jewish, which is affiliated with McGill, and so it is unfortunately have a limited capacity. But we specialize in people with special cancer risk situations, such as genetic predisposition and so on. But it is possible to arrange an appointment to discuss with a doctor on a private basis cancer risk reduction questions.
If you are a patient that has non-small cell cancer and your breathing is difficult, how can you exercise?
Clearly, when it comes down to performance, and this is what the root of this question is addressing. We've had people with fairly severe lung cancer exercising on a bicycle ergometer at zero resistance, zero, and their heart rates were elevated. They were able to take in the air that they needed in order to consume the oxygen to do the work, but. You have to really ask yourself, the work that they were doing was quite minimal, and this was about the limits of their capacity. But I do know as the lung cancer worsens, then clearly the level and intensity of the exercise must unfortunately decrease.
What are the differences between small cell carcinoma, basal, squamous, and any other type, in a nutshell?
Well, it's not really a cancer prevention question, but, you know, these cancers differ from each other in many, many ways. The exact molecular lesions are different. You know, they all share that something's wrong with the DNA, but what's wrong with the DNA is a little bit different. Which exact cell populations are actually responsible, like which cell something went wrong with, that's also different, and the clinical course and responsivity to therapy is also different. So that's actually a question that's an important one, but I don't think we can go further into it. It's a little off topic, and it would take a long time.
So So I thank you very much for being here tonight and giving us some pointers. I'd like to thank the volunteers who've helped to organize this story. But before you run away, Madame Annette, you are the heart of this, and you've been promoting this for the last 4 years. It's a pleasure to work with you on this, and I hope we do it again next year. Thank you so much. I would also like to profoundly thank Mr. and Mrs. Goodman for supporting this public lecture series. As you can see, it's growing and it's catching on. And this was your intention in the beginning. And I think tonight we can honestly say we've reached our goal.
Rangers 1, Canadians 2. 3 minutes and 30 seconds of the first period to go.
Please fill in your survey so that we know what you would like to hear next year. And as you go out, there'll be people picking it up.
Keep it short. It's amazing how fast it goes.